What do you get when you combine Donald Trump, two debates, and a third-party challenge? I don't know about you, but to me, it sounds like the political junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. So what's the long-range prognosis about Donald Trump and the Republican Party?
I think if he's treated fairly in the Republican process, that won't happen. Don't try to block him from the debates. Don't try to keep him off the ballot, and he'll stay in the Republican Party.
What hoops would he need to jump through to run as a third-party candidate?
I don't want to do the independent thing, but I do keep it, and it is leverage, and it is. There are some very positive things about keeping it.
Plus, we revisit the 1980 Democratic Convention, where President Jimmy Carter tried to unite the party for the upcoming battle with Ronald Reagan.
From foreign policy to domestic policy to a very weak economy, nothing was going right that last year when he was preparing to run again.
That's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
And like to you, and lean to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 89 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. If you thought last week's Republican debate would mostly be the Donald Trump show, you were pretty much correct. From the word go.
Is there anyone on stage, and can I see hands, who is unwilling tonight to pledge your support to the eventual nominee of the Republican Party and pledge to not run an independent campaign against that person? Again, we're looking for you to raise your hand now. Raise your hand now if you won't make that pledge tonight. Mr. Trump.
So. And of course, there was this.
You've called women you don't like fat pigs, dogs, slobs, and disgusting animals. Your Twitter account
only
is
Rosie
several...
O'Donnell.
No, it wasn't. Your Twitter account.
Thank you.
For the record, it was well beyond Rosie O'Donnell.
Yes, I'm sure it was.
Your Twitter account has several...
But that's just scratching the surface. We'll have more on the debate and Trump later in the show. And yes, we'll let the other candidates speak as well. The earlier debate that day, the one comprised of the seven Republicans who didn't make it into the top 10, had its moments as well. Now, I really hate declaring winners and losers in debates, but by most accounts, the winner was Cauley Fiorina. She defended American values.
This is a great nation. It is a unique nation in all of human history and on the face of the planet, because here our founders believed that everyone has a right to fulfill their potential, and that that right, they called it life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, comes from God and cannot be taken away by government.
And she spent plenty of time bashing Hillary Clinton.
Hillary Clinton lies about Benghazi. She lies about emails. She is still defending Planned Parenthood, and she is still her party's front runner.
But if Fiorina is going to make any impact, she probably needs to leave the kids' table and get into the next debate with the adults. That debate is on September 16th at the Reagan Library in California. The Democrats announced their debate schedule, too, starting October 13th in Nevada. There were some 25 Democratic debates in the 2008 cycle, but only six party-sanctioned debates this time. The DNC has instituted a rule that any candidate who participates in a non-sanctioned debate will be barred from the official ones. And look at the schedule. The Iowa debate, 2.5 months before the caucuses. The New Hampshire debate, the weekend before Christmas. All of that has infuriated Martin O'Malley and some other Democrats who claim the DNC has stacked the deck in Hillary Clinton's favor. Meanwhile, in Mississippi, the Democratic establishment didn't fare so well. Its nominee for governor was supposed to be Vicki Slater, a politically active attorney. Instead, a truck driver by the name of Robert Gray, making his first foray into politics, easily won the primary. He raised no money, he spent no money, he bought no advertising. He didn't even vote for himself. Nonetheless, he carried 79 of the state's 82 counties and beat Slater by more than 20 points. Republican Governor Phil Bryant is heavily favored to win a second term. Voters may not have seen Robert Gray on television, but that can't be said about Laura Ingalls Wilder, the young girl who was played by actress Melissa Gilbert on the 1970s TV show Little House on the Prairie.
I've decided something.
What's that, Heffa?
Home is the nicest word there is.
Back then, she was talking about home. Now she's talking about house, as in the U.S. House of Representatives. Gilbert announced this week that she will seek the Democratic nomination to take on Michigan Congressman Mike Bishop in 2016. A TV star running for office? Unthinkable, right? Well, here's a thinkable trivia question. Who was the first star of a television series elected to Congress? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner, as always, will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. We'll give you the answer to last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned. Guess who's starting another program by talking about Donald Trump? I know. But when it comes to sizing up the Republican field, the conversation continues to revolve around him. His responses to Fox News debate moderator Megyn Kelly, questions about a potential third-party candidacy. Then came the firing of a top advisor, Roger Stone. Or did Stone leave on his own accord? Well, we thought we'd ask him. After all, there are few people in politics who know Trump well enough to talk about him and live to tell the tale. Roger Stone is one of them, and he joins us on The Political Junkie. Roger, it's great to have you on the program.
Ken, it's great to be here.
In all the years I've been reading about a potential and now realized Trump presidential campaign, your name has always been associated with the effort. How long have you known him?
I actually met Donald Trump in 1979 when I was sent to New York to organize then-former Governor Ronald Reagan's campaign for president. And I was given a card file that belonged to Nancy Reagan of their friends in New York, a little like a menu, like a recipe file. And there were maybe 60, 70 cards in it. The problem was that half the people on those cards were dead. But among the cards was a card for Roy Cohn, the flamboyant and famous New York attorney, who I, of course, had read about, knew about, but didn't, of course, know.
Joe McCarthy's former aide.
Joe McCarthy's old running mate. And I contacted Cohn, and I told him what I wanted. And he said, well, do you know Fred and Donald Trump? And I said, no, I don't. I only know of them. They said, well, Fred's a great conservative. And, in fact, Fred Trump, Donald's father, was one of the original financiers of the Goldwater campaign. And you need to meet them because I think they'd be interested. So I met Donald's father. Then I subsequently met him. And they both signed on our finance committee. Donald was very important to our effort in a couple ways, helped us get office space, helped us get phones installed on a faster basis, lent us his plane to file our petitions, to fly our petitions to Albany at the very last minute to get on the ballot. And we became fast friends in 1980 when Reagan was elected. I opened my lobbying practice, Black, Manafort, Stone, and Kelly, lined up most of the dictators in the world that we could find. Pro-Western dictators, of course.
The good dictators.
The good ones. Because, dictators are in the eye of the beholder. In any event, he was among my first clients. I handled some currency transaction issues regarding his casinos and Treasury and new rules that they were passing. I handled some FAA building height questions because some of the skyscrapers he was building were scraping the sky as far as the federal government was concerned. And in other issues, I secured permits to secure the dredging of the harbor in Atlantic City so he could bring his incredible yacht in. We became very good friends. I've wanted him to run for president since 1988 when I arranged for the Portsmouth, New Hampshire Chamber of Commerce to do a luncheon speech, where he absolutely wowed them. And it was standing room only. Some very enthusiastic friends of mine in New Hampshire organized the very first Trump for President or Draft Trump Committee. But it was early in his business career. He wasn't really that interested in politics as an avocation. He was more interested in politics as an observer and donor. Then fast forward to 2000, when both he and I were unimpressed with the choice between Al Gore and George W. Bush. Ross Perot, Jesse Ventura, and others, Jesse then the governor, urged him to seek the Reform Party nomination. As you know, Ken, the Reform Party in those days had federal matching funds, which made that nomination attractive. I was the chairman of his exploratory committee. There was actually a straw poll at the National Reform Party Convention in Dearborn, Michigan, that Trump won. But in the end, he elected not to make that race.
Let me ask you about that. I mean, he's talked about running as a third-party candidate in 2000, as you say. He's talking about it now, again now. He used to be a Democrat. He gave money to Hillary Clinton, to Nancy Pelosi, to Harry Reid. He was pro-choice. He was pro-single payer. And yet conservatives love him. Please explain that to me.
Well, I learned something a long time ago. In politics, you stand for what you stand for today. People are allowed to change their minds on the basis of information and developments. I mean, you saw in the debate, he was asked, well, you're a Republican today, used to be a Democrat. Yeah, he pointed to Jeb Bush and said, yeah, his brother took care of that. I mean, why would anybody, any Republican support the massive spending under George W. Bush or Medicaid Part D or any of the other crazy things that they did? So he had a period of estrangement from the party, but he had good reason. As far as contributions to Democrats, yeah, he played the game. If you're in business, you play the game. You give to both sides because they don't even listen to you unless you pony up. But it's a broken system. It's a system I think only he could fix. I don't read anything ideological into those contributions. The two senators from New York asked him for money, gave them money. He owns companies with thousands of employees in this state. They don't even listen to you unless you give them a dough.
But you know that, you've been around Republican politics for a long time. You know that if a GOP crowd hears that a candidate gave to the enemy, to the other side, they're automatically suspect.
Well, hasn't hurt him so far. Look, George H.W. Bush once called tax cuts voodoo economics, and he was pro-choice. Then he ran for vice president praising the tax cuts and said he was pro-life. Unfortunately, or perhaps just as an observation, politics, your political position is what you say it is today. Trump talks about the fact that a friend of his had a baby late in life, and that baby is precious, and they considered aborting that baby, and they elected not to. And that forced him to change his views. I respect that. I have enormous respect for that.
I guess we kind of know who Donald Trump is. Who's Roger Stone? And I think the reason I ask that question is because every description, and you know this as well as anybody, you're always referred to as a Nixon dirty trickster, a hitman. You worked for Ronald Reagan, but you also worked for Arlen Specter. And now I understand you're a member of the Libertarian Party. Who's Roger Stone?
I'm an outsider. I've never been an establishmentarian, so people forget this, but Ronald Reagan was the outsider candidate in 1980, as he was in 76. He certainly was in 76 when we challenged Gerald Ford, and I was on his staff then. He certainly was in 1980 when the establishment, both financial and political, was for George Bush or John Connolly. I'm against the establishment. I'm an outsider. I think the two-party system is corrupted. I think that the Clintons and the Bushes are in it together. To a certain extent, the Republicans and the Democrats are in it together. The policies of Clinton and Bush and Obama are identical in every way. Endless war, erosion of our civil liberties, massive spending, huge debt. The list goes on and on and on. The two parties endeavor to sound different. They really try to sound different, but in truth, they're exactly the same. They're big government parties, big spending parties, big spying parties, and so on. So I'm an outsider. I am a libertarian. I cast my last vote in Florida as a Republican in the primary for Ron Paul, because I am a philosophical libertarian. And then I left the Republican Party. I make no bones about it. I'm an outsider, and I'm not an anarchist, although I have a lot of friends who are. But I'm an anti-establishmentarian. That's what attracts me to Trump, you see, is that he's the one guy with the financial wherewithal to be independent. Independent of the PACs, independent of the lobbyists, independent of the Koch brothers, independent of the special interests, independent of the special pleaders. This is what attracts me to Trump. It's also why I think Trump is surging. It's also why Bernie Sanders is surging. People view both of them as outsiders. not part of the establishment, radicals in their way. It's a very healthy thing for America, in my view.
Would you rather Trump run as a Republican or as a third-party candidate?
Well, the third-party gambit is very simply insurance against being worked over by the Republican establishment. Look, according to the New York Times, three of those candidates on the stage last week were in talks about boycotting the debate if Trump were included. And this is according to Maggie Haberman of the New York Times. And she said the three top candidates, so that would be Bush, Walker, and Rubio at that time. In 15, it may even be 18 states, the Republican state chairman can keep Trump off the ballot with the stroke of a pen. And therefore, if he's not treated fairly, if he's not given an even shot, a fair shot at the nomination, if the establishment tries to move to block him, the way, by the way, they blocked Ron Paul. When Ron Paul got the six states necessary to put his name in nomination, the Romney people changed the rule quickly to eight. And they wonder why they lost. They wonder why he didn't endorse Romney. Politics is about inclusion. It's not about exclusion, as my old client, New Jersey Governor Tom H. Kane, used to say.
You were in the news recently amid reports that Trump fired you from the campaign, and you said no, that you fired him. What's the story?
Well, he most definitely did not fire me. Both the New York Times and Politico have at least three and now four witnesses who I showed my resignation letter to in advance and told them I had decided to resign in the wake of the distraction regarding his fight with Megyn Kelly. So so much for that. I very definitely resigned. I was not fired. But I harbor no ill will. I'm for Donald Trump. I want to do anything I possibly can to break the political establishment in this country and to break up the cozy relationship between the Bushes and the Clintons, who, when they're not looting Ponzi scams like Innovita and Miami together, they're giving each other medals. And now you see Hillary attacking Jeb, Jeb attacking Hillary. Ken, they're propping each other up. They want to run against each other because they're in it together.
I think it's fair to say that the mainstream media have been wrong about Trump from the get-go. He belittles John McCain's record. We expect him to pay the price in the polls. He doesn't. He says something that is very controversial. We say he's on his way out. We're wrong again. So what do you make of his performance in the debate? Was it good? Was it bad? Was it helpful?
I think he had his moments. I mean, look, he's not a professional politician. He's never done this before, not at this level. I mean, the debate specifically. He's a very, very dynamic speaker, and he's great at Q&A, but the debate format was foreign to him. He had his moments. I mean, let's take the bankruptcies in Atlantic City. He took advantage of the bankruptcy laws. And, yeah, he screwed some very, very, very wealthy banks, no question about it. That's the guy I want handling the federal treasury. That's the guy I want handling the federal budget. That's not dumb. That's smart. Those are the rules. He played by the rules as they're established. I think that, in truth, he even won the exchange with Megyn Kelly by changing it from a question of his discussion of women to a question of politically correctness. In the end, I believe he apologized to her. In fact, he said, if you don't like what I say, I'm sorry.
Actually, I think he said, if you don't like what I said, too bad, is I think what he said.
That may be. I believe he came out of the debate fine. I had my disagreements, as I have said, and I don't want to belabor this, were with the following day. In other words, politics to me is about issues, big, sweeping issues, and putting enough memorable phrases behind them for the electorate. The electorate don't want a wonk. Ask President Gingrich how that works. They're not that interested in getting in the weeds. What they want is somebody who's going to explain the broad detail, the broad sweep of his ideas. The Chinese are taking us to the cleaners in our trade agreements. They're stealing our jobs and they're spying on us. They're stealing our technology through espionage. The Mexicans are laughing at us. Trump is exactly right. As far as John McCain is concerned, I know you've lived in Washington a while, Ken. People don't like John McCain. Republican voters don't like John McCain. The only people who like John McCain are the reporters who live inside the Beltway.
Back to Donald Trump. Do you see any scenario in which he becomes the Republican nominee?
It's certainly possible. This race is completely wide open. And the other candidates, frankly, are underperforming. I don't see anybody underperforming as badly as Jeb, given the resources he has. But he's just not ready for prime time. He is making the biggest mistake you can make in politics. As my old boss, Richard Nixon, used to say, the only thing in politics worse than being wrong is being boring. And he's boring the voters to death.
Look, I know there's no love lost between you and the Republican Party, but what about this argument that I guess Bret Baier tried to make the case, the Fox News moderator? He runs, he's dissed by the Republican establishment, he runs as an independent, and that leads to the election of Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, I think if he's treated fairly in the Republican process, that won't happen. Don't try to block him from the debates, don't try to keep him off the ballot, and he'll stay in the Republican Party. If he did run as a third-party candidate, I'll give you Stone's prediction. The Democrats probably win, Trump runs second, and the Republicans run third. Welcome to 1912.
I guess what you're saying is that it really wouldn't matter if Hillary Clinton or Jeb Bush won this election?
Not to me. Their policies are identical. They're on the take from the exact same people. If anybody in their right mind thinks Hillary Clinton is going to tackle Wall Street, they're kidding themselves. She's lining her pockets, she and her husband, from Wall Street, both personally and politically.
It's been less than 2 months and the race continues to be dominated by Trump. Is that a good thing, a bad thing?
I think it's an amazing thing. I mean, even you would have to agree that, and I would agree with you, that I've seen the Trump phenomena up close. I understand his populist appeal and the fact that he's charismatic, but even I am shocked that he has soared the way he has.
Roger, you've been in politics. You've been involved in politics, both inside the Republican Party, outside the Republican, for decades. You've never seen anything like this, have you?
I really haven't. It's extremely exciting because it is totally outside the conventional wisdom rules. I don't think the conventional wisdom applies to Donald Trump. And frankly, I still think his prospects for nomination and even election are very bright.
Roger Stone is a longtime political operative going back to the Nixon campaign. He's also a longtime associate of Donald Trump, though currently on the outs with him. And he's on Twitter at Roger J. Stone, J.R., as in Junior. Roger Stone, thanks so much for being on the show.
And, you know, those of us who are Trump loyalists use a special hashtag. Hashtag huge. Y-U-G-E. Trump is huge.
Roger Stone, this was a huge interview. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Ken. Take care.
Donald Trump says he would rather not leave the Republican Party and run as an independent, but if the party leaders don't treat him nice, well, he could see it happening. What hoops would Trump have to jump through to be a credible independent or third-party candidate? What steps would he have to take to get on the ballot? Well, nobody knows the answers to those questions more than Richard Winger. He's the editor and publisher of Ballot Access News in San Francisco and a longtime expert on this stuff. Richard, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me.
Well, obviously, one of the first things anybody looking at an independent campaign has to think of is the filing deadlines to get on the ballot. And I know that each state has its own deadline, but when do they generally begin to start?
The vast majority are in July, August, and September.
2016?
Yes.
So Donald Trump has a long way to go before there's any kind of deadline for him to make a decision.
Well, there's a few outliers. The worst one is Texas, which has a kind of irrational May 9th petition deadline for independent presidential candidates, but crazily says independent candidates for other office don't need their petitions in until June 26th. So if Trump or anybody had to challenge the May 9th deadline in Texas, I think it would be an easy victory. It's just kind of an accident of bad drafting that Texas has that disparity.
Is there a difference regarding deadlines and qualifications to run as an independent as opposed to a third-party candidate?
Every state has its own rules. Every state is required by the Constitution to have procedures for both. Rationally, you'd think they'd be about the same, but there's a lot of irrational ballot access laws out there. I mean, Texas has a much earlier petition deadline for an independent presidential candidate than it does for a whole new party. They're just all over the map.
Now, to get on the ballot, is it filing signatures? Is it a filing fee? Is it both? Or does it depend?
It all depends. There's two states where you don't need a petition because you just need a filing fee. That's Louisiana and Colorado. But the typical law requires a petition, and it can be a tiny number of signatures or a big number of signatures. Tennessee is only 275 signatures for an independent presidential candidate. North Carolina is 89,000 and something.
When we think of these kind of candidates, we think of Ross Perot or John Anderson, the independent who ran in 1980, or George Wallace in 68. But each election cycle, there are numerous candidates who managed to make it on the ballot in each state, right?
Yes. However, in the entire history of the United States, there has never been more than seven presidential candidates who had enough candidates for presidential elector to theoretically win the election. And that's including the major parties. So there has never been a presidential election in U.S. history with more than five people running outside the major parties who could theoretically have won.
You mean in the same year?
Yeah.
How many candidates were on every state's ballot in 2012?
Gary Johnson was only on in 48. He was the Libertarian. And Jill Stein was on in 37. She was the Green. And, of course, the Democrats and Republicans were on in all states. So there were only four people in 2012 who theoretically could have been elected. Gary Johnson missed two states, Oklahoma and Michigan. He missed Oklahoma because it was just too many signatures. But this year, the Oklahoma legislature reduce the number of signatures.
There are also several states that have sore loser laws. Explain that.
A sore loser law says if you run in a major party primary and are defeated, then you can't get on the ballot as an independent or minor party candidate for November. The reason presidential primaries generally aren't affected by sore loser laws is that no person is defeated for the Republican presidential nomination or the Democratic nomination in any one state's primary. It's the national conventions that pick them. So the logic of sore loser laws just doesn't apply to presidential primaries.
So you could be John Anderson and lose a Republican primary, or Gary Johnson and lose a presidential primary, and yet still run as an independent in the fall and not have to worry about sore loser laws.
Yes. There's 12 people in history have run in major party presidential primaries and then ran outside the major parties in the general election. And until 2012, none of them, no minor party candidate had ever been kept off the general election ballot on the grounds that he or she had run in a major party presidential primary. But that was broken in 2012 when Michigan Secretary of State wouldn't let Gary Johnson on the ballot in Michigan as a Libertarian, because his name had been in the Republican presidential primary ballot. But Michigan said, but you can be an independent candidate.
Now, I know this is dealing with a hypothetical and is a tough question to ask, but theoretically, at least, could Republicans in various state legislatures say, well, Donald Trump is a sore loser and we're not going to let him run as an independent, or we think that's not likely to happen?
Well, most state legislatures aren't in session, so they would have to do that next year. And we have about a dozen court precedents that say states cannot make the ballot access laws harder right in the middle of an election season because that violates due process. For instance, in 2013, the Ohio legislature passed a bill kicking four minor parties off the ballot. And a U.S. district court judge said, well, you can pass this law, but you can't make it effective in 2014 because that's just not fair. You can't change the rules in an adverse direction once the election season has started.
If Trump runs in the primaries, fails to make headway, and then decides to run as an independent, realistically, when would a decision like that have to be made? You talked about deadlines in the summer, but when would the signature filing process begin?
Well, John Anderson made that decision in April 24th, 1980. He had been seeking the Republican nomination, and it was obvious to everybody that Ronald Reagan was going to get it. So on April 24th, he pulled out of the Republican race and declared as an independent, and he got on the ballot in all 50 states. So I would say April is the key month.
I think only the editor of Ballot Access News would know the date that John Anderson dropped out and filed as an independent.
Well, it's one of those dates for me that, you know, everybody says, where were you on September 11th? Where were you when President Kennedy was assassinated?
Where was John Anderson when he ran as an independent?
That date resonates for me the same way. That was pretty thrilling.
Richard Winger is the editor of Ballot Access News and a leading expert on, well, ballot access. And this may come as a shock, but he's on Twitter at ballot_access. Richard, thanks a lot for being on the program.
Okay, thank you, Ken.
It's time for This Week in Political History. The Democrats weren't in an especially hopeful mood as they were getting ready for their presidential nominating convention in 1980, 35 years ago this week. Unlike 1976, which turned into a love fest for Jimmy Carter, the 1980 event at Madison Square Garden was filled with bitterness. Senator Edward Kennedy had taken his challenge to the president all the way to the convention. And all the while, sitting back, watching the Democratic family feud with glee, was the Republican nominee, former California Governor Ronald Reagan. Julian Zelizer is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He has written many books about Congress and policy, and is also the author of Jimmy Carter, a biography of the 39th president. Professor Zelizer, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me.
Now, everything seemed to go President Carter's way during his first race in 1976. He had a divided Democratic opposition. He had the public's anger over Watergate and President Ford's pardon of Richard Nixon. But running for president seemed to be much easier than being president for Jimmy Carter.
Absolutely. When Carter ran in 1976, the country was trying to get over Watergate, and Carter had been the perfect candidate for that election. He had been the person who was able to tap into those feelings in the American public about wanting trust in government again and wanting to restore confidence in Washington. But by 1980, he was the incumbent, and he had all the problems that come with incumbency. And in addition to a rising right-wing Republican Party through Ronald Reagan, he also had many Democrats, including Ted Kennedy, who were greatly frustrated with his first term.
And you also, even before you get to the convention, you had the hostage situation, you had the rise in oil prices, you had all these things that seemed to be going wrong at the same time.
It was a horrible year for Jimmy Carter. The hostage crisis really gave many Americans the impression that the nation was being held hostage to a new force in international affairs. The country was dealing with a second round of oil shocks and waiting in line for gas and feeling frustrated. And everything Jimmy Carter did, including a famous speech he gives to try to deal with the energy crisis, backfires on him. And so from foreign policy to domestic policy to a very weak economy, nothing was going right that last year when he was preparing to run again.
Okay, so bring us back to those days in 1980. The Democrats are getting ready to assemble in New York for their convention. What did Carter, I mean, we all assumed, unless they changed the rules, that Carter's renomination was not in jeopardy. So what did Carter hope to accomplish at the Garden?
Well, the primaries had been pretty brutal. He had survived them, and he was pretty confident that he could withstand Ted Kennedy's challenge to him at the convention to try to get delegates to switch their vote. But it had been a difficult primary. I mean, Ted Kennedy had made the argument that Carter had moved too far to the center of the political spectrum and that he had tried to sound too much like a Republican to win over moderate and independent voters. Kennedy had argued that the party has to be proud, that Democrats have to embrace their traditions, and that Carter in some ways was a phony. And many people really liked Kennedy. They liked both his message and him, and they found him inspiring, whereas Carter, they were just tolerating. And so by the time the convention starts, you know, Carter's still trying to get over the wounds of the primary, and one of the things he wants to accomplish is to re-energize Democrats about his candidacy and to convince them that he, in fact, was the rightful person to be running for re-election and to be running for the presidency, and that the Kennedy Democrats needed to support him.
Well, usually, the goal of a convention is to unite the party and smooth over its differences. Was that accomplished in New York?
No, not at all. The convention doesn't go well for him. The most famous moment from the convention comes when Kennedy appears, and Kennedy receives the kind of response from the delegates that, you know, Carter by this point can only dream of. He gives a very rousing speech, and the delegates are brought to their feet.
Here's a little bit of that tape.
For me, a few hours ago, this campaign came to an end. For all those whose cares have been our concern, the work goes on, the cause endures, the hope still lives, and the dream shall never die.
That's pretty intense stuff.
It was. I think it was intense stuff both because it was a very powerful piece of oratory, but it was also this key moment for the Democratic Party when the 70s were ending and the party was feeling that it was in jeopardy, that, you know, you have these Republicans who are really going after them, the Democratic policies and the economy weren't working and foreign policy. So there was something about hearing Kennedy be proud of his party that I think made that speech really special. And so he gives this speech at the convention, and it just brings back all the tensions that existed in the primaries. And then, you know, Kennedy doesn't really go to shake Carter's hand when he's called onto the stage. And there's this famous scene where Carter looks like he's literally running after Kennedy, trying to shake his hand and trying to have the famous victory pose, which doesn't happen. And physically, the whole scene disintegrates and turns into yet more evidence that these two Democrats and these two factions of the Democratic Party don't really like each other.
Well, I think Carter actually acknowledges the party's differences in his acceptance speech.
We're Democrats, and we've had our differences, but we share a bright vision of America's future, a vision of a good life for all our people, a vision of a secure nation, a just society, a peaceful world, a strong America, confident and proud and united. And we have a memory of Franklin Roosevelt 40 years ago when he said that there are times in our history when concern over our personal lives are overshadowed by our concern over what will happen to the country we have known. This is such a time.
Somehow that doesn't seem as inspiring as Senator Kennedy's speech.
It doesn't. Carter was obviously trying to, you know, reach back to the same kind of traditions that Kennedy was talking about, and talking about the party of FDR, and that ultimately the party was more united than divided, despite what the delegates had seen. But, you know, Carter didn't have the same power of speech that Kennedy did. And more importantly, by 1980, when he's delivering this speech to the delegates, he's worn out. He's had a difficult first term, and many people, Democrats and Republicans, are very frustrated with his presidency. So part of it is the speech, and part of it is the context of that speech, which made it very hard for people at the time to, you know, just stand up and roar for this president who seemed to be having so many problems and who seemed to be having trouble listening to the constituents of the country in terms of what they needed.
And it also seemed like rather than focus on what was going on in the present, Carter basically spent a lot of the speech going into the party's past, hoping to remind voters of great Democratic presidents of the past.
We'll win because we're the party of a great president who knew how to get reelected, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And we're the party of a courageous fighter who knew how to give them hell, Harry Truman. And we're the party of a gallant man of spirit, John Fitzgerald Kennedy. And we're the party of a great leader of compassion, Lyndon Baines Johnson.
And of course, in listing of the great Democrats of the past, he also made this famous blunder.
And the party of a great man who should have been president and who would have been one of the greatest presidents in history, Hubert Horatio Hornblower.
Hubert Horatio Hornblower.
Right. you know, it's an odd part of the speech where you're talking more about previous presidents than yourself, and then you make a mistake for someone who is still very much on the minds of Democrats who represented what was good about the Democratic Party. So
Ultimately, he's making gaffes in his speech, and he can't speak about himself because the year was going so poorly. He was a president who was facing really a crisis of leadership. And so, you know, he's talking about everyone other than himself, and that's never good at your convention.
When President Carter was trying to tell the delegates, you know, how good things were and how things were okay and they'll get better, I think of, you know, we heard the great Kennedy speech earlier, the famous thing about the dream will never die. But he also, when Kennedy was giving his concession speech, he didn't paint a pretty picture of what he saw during the campaign.
I have listened to young workers out of work, to students without the tuition for college, and to families without the chance to own a home. I have seen the closed factories and the stalled assembly lines of Anderson, Indiana, and Southgate, California. And I have seen too many, far too many, idle men and women desperate to work. I have seen too many, far too many, working families desperate to protect the value of their wages from the ravages of inflation.
I mean, that sounds like something Ronald Reagan could have said.
Absolutely, and it was accurate. I mean, that was the problem. We forget just how bad the situation was in the 1970s, and many Americans felt this real sense of crisis. And in terms of everything from foreign policy to the economy, nothing was going well. And certainly if you were a middle-class American, you were terrified about the insecurity that you faced, about the loss of jobs that was taking place. And there was this feeling that it wasn't going to get better. And so I think Kennedy was speaking the truth on those issues. And Carter, who was aware of them, who was concerned about them, couldn't really find the words to explain to Americans not just what was wrong, but what he was going to do better. And that became pretty devastating for his presidency. And when Ronald Reagan, you know, promised to restore this country through tax cuts and fighting communism, people listened.
When all was said and done, what did the 1980 convention do for the Democrats' chances in November?
Well, it hurt them. It's okay to have a tough primary. It's okay to challenge an incumbent. But when you get down to the convention and the convention doesn't really resolve the differences, it in fact amplifies them, it's never a good thing. And Ronald Reagan was just waiting. He was feeling very positive, very confident, and he felt as if he was really the rising voice of the Republican Party. So they leave this convention, the Democrats, divided, and Carter is feeling that a lot of people are not very enthusiastic about him, and they're right, and the Republicans are in a very different situation. So I think the convention just ended a very difficult and debilitating primary season for the incumbent.
Julian Zelizer is a presidential historian at Princeton University. In addition to Jimmy Carter, his books include Taxing America, Wilbur D. Mills, Congress and the State, 1945 to 1975, The Politics of National Security, from World War II to the War on Terrorism, and Conservatives in Power, the Reagan Years, 1981 to 1989. He can be found on Twitter at Julian Zelizer. Professor Zelizer, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
It was 35 years ago this week when the Democrats renominated President Jimmy Carter at their 1980 convention in New York City. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie. It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, who is the most senior Republican on Capitol Hill today, House or Senate, who came to Congress by defeating a GOP incumbent in the primary? The answer, Fred Upton. The Michigan Republican defeated Congressman Mark Siljander in the 1986 GOP primary and has served ever since. And the randomly selected winner is Thad Beyer of Lafayette, California. Thad wins the coveted Political Junkie button, so there's no reason for him to be Thad. And don't forget, we have a new Scuttlebutton puzzle up. You can see it and solve it at our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com. Democrats in Pennsylvania were ecstatic over last year's elections, in which they unseated the incumbent Republican governor. Lately, however, the news for the Democrats in the Keystone State has not been great. Last month, Chaka Fattah, who has represented West Philadelphia in Congress the past two decades, was indicted on bribery and other crimes. Politically, Democrats could probably deal with the Fattah indictment. No matter what happens, it will still be a safe Democratic district. But another indictment, this one against Kathleen Kane, the state attorney general, is more damaging. She was considered a rising star in the party, somebody being groomed for governor or the U.S. Senate, or whatever she wanted, actually. That plan may be forever scuttled. Terry Madonna is a leading commentator of Keystone State politics. He's a professor of public affairs at Franklin and Marshall College in Lancaster and publishes the Politically Uncorrected column. Terry, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me, Ken.
Let's start with Congressman Fattah. He has a safe seat in Congress. He hasn't had a real challenge since he first won it in 1994. He probably could have been a congressman for life, right?
Oh, there's no doubt about it. And you know, he was always considered when he was in the state house and then the state senate in Pennsylvania before he moved on to Congress to be something of a policy wonk. He is a senior Democrat on the Appropriation Committee. And, you know, at some point, if the Democrats were to gain control, you know, in a few years, he could have been chairman of the committee. Very, very powerful individual. And as you point out, fell a cropper, I think, of a failed mayoral campaign in the city of Philly in 2007 when he had to borrow a large sum of money. It was actually the charges that he took a $1 million campaign loan that was illegal and then misappropriated funds to pay part of it off. And that's how he gets to not one, not two, not three, not five, but a 29-count indictment against him. And questions are now being raised about whether he should resign or not. He has indicated he won't resign. That's not uncommon, by the way, as you know, for many politicians to remain in office pending a trial or pending a deal that they can get with a U.S. attorney in this case.
Well, right. I mean, obviously, we know he stepped down as the ranking Democrat on the Appropriations Subcommittee, and that's required by House rules. And as you point out, he insists he'll seek re-election next year. But one, do you think he will? And two, what are his prospects? We've seen members of Congress get renominated and even re-elected while under indictment.
First of all, no one knows for sure what he's likely to do. He says he's going to run. We take him at his word on that. He wouldn't be the first criminally charged political leader, congressman, state senator, or whatever, state house member, you pick the office to try to work out a deal for, you know, drop some charges, lesser recommendation for, you know, perhaps a minimum or no jail time. By the way, there was a member of Congress from Philadelphia back in 1979 by the name of Letter.
Ray Letter, I knew you were going to mention him.
Yeah, I mean, he was caught up in that situation when an Arab sheikh.
Abscam.
Yep, Arab sheikh offered him a bribe. It was really a federal agent, as you know. And he ran, by the way, I'm getting to this point. He ran for re-election in 1980. And imagine this, he won by 22 points. So, I mean, I think the congressman would probably be pretty safe in that in the district that he's virtually owned, as you accurately point out. And time will tell whether he runs or not.
So basically, Philadelphians are known for booing Santa Claus and reelecting indicted congressmen.
That's exactly right. And other members, by the way, over the years who've been, you know, charged with various crimes, not members of Congress particularly, but members of the state house and other officials have remained in office. Under Pennsylvania law, if you get convicted, you don't have to surrender your office until you're sentenced. Now, think about that for a minute. That could mean a gap of 3 or 4 months. you would not legally have to surrender your office. Translation, you're still being paid. Now, Congress is different, but I'm talking about a myriad possibilities in Pennsylvania for a whole host of other officials, namely the Attorney General of the state, should she get convicted.
Before we get to her, staying with Chaka Fatah for a second, do we both agree that whatever happens to him, the seat stays in Democratic hands?
There's no doubt about that. The only question is who would be the replacement, and there's been all kinds of speculation about that already. Mayor Nutter is winding down his tenure. There's a state senator named Anthony Williams who lost the mayoral bid. I mean, the list goes on of possibilities. And this is an important point, African-Americans are more than half of the population of the city, and there's literally only one African-American in the entire Pennsylvania delegation. So it seems to me that African-American leaders, and rightfully so, I think, would, you know, demand and want an African-American to replace him. There are a couple of names of white politicos who have been mentioned, but I think that's pretty much out of the question.
Okay, now back to Kathleen Kane. What she's been accused of, it almost seems childish. I mean, not that perjury and obstruction of justice are to be taken lightly, but it seems to be about trying to embarrass a critic.
The indictment has a whole variety of things in it, from perjury to contempt to official obstruction. Those are some of the more serious charges that have been leveled against her. And it goes to this. A newspaper, the Philadelphia Inquirer, got information from a leak that said that she shuttered an investigation into some Philadelphia lawmakers and a traffic judge.
All Democrats.
And an African-American, that she shut it down. As a result of that, she tried to get in, the allegation is, into another grand jury investigation that was not pursued by her predecessors. And that's where it gets into this conspiracy. Her predecessor, she would argue, shut down an investigation of the former head of the Philadelphia NAACP, a guy named Jerry Mondesire, and they shut that investigation down that he misused federal, you know, monies that should have gone for certain purposes that were converted to other purposes. So here we got two separate investigations. The complaint says that she went into the second grand jury in order to get information to expose the fact that they shut down this investigation of Mondesire that they shouldn't have. You see where this all goes. And it's a question then of leaks and cover-ups, that's the allegation. It's very complicated and not easy to explain in a couple of minutes.
Okay, tell me a little bit about Kane prior to this scandal. I mean, she was the first Democrat, the first woman to become Attorney General, right, since the position became elective. And she made a name for herself by criticizing Corbett for the job he did with the Penn State sex scandal and Jerry Sandusky. So she seemed to have a limitless political future.
After the first year, I mean, there were actually discussions not just about her being governor, but I think it was Chris Matthews on Hardball suggested that she could be a vice presidential candidate. I mean, the sky was the limit. And you forgot, and there was another big thing. She refused to defend the Pennsylvania's Defense of Marriage Act and let it go to the governor's office. And the governor's office, that would have been Corbett at the time, did not. When a federal judge overturned Pennsylvania's Defense of Marriage Act, the governor did not appeal that. So for all practical purposes, same-sex marriages became legal in Pennsylvania. And she was very popular because gay marriage is popular in the state, and particularly more in Democratic circles and Republican circles. So to put an exclamation point on it, her stock was very big. But then she goes through a series of miscues, and I don't know how many of them you want me to get into, but they began to damage her reputation. Then it begins to unravel even more. So after the first year, which was well-received, very popular, it all just unravels one step after another, with Democrats increasingly pulling away from her, not wanting to, you know, get too much involved with her because of their damaged reputation.
Well, Tom Wolf, who's the current governor and a fellow Democrat, He said that the charges were serious and troubling, and it suggested that she step down from her position, but she says she won't.
That's correct. The only other statewide office holder in a governmental, not a judicial office, Eugene De Pasquale, he's the state's auditor general. He's also called on her to resign. Her problem right now is that not only has she said she won't resign, but it's still unclear whether she'll seek re-election. She has said, you know, as recently as a couple of weeks ago, that she intends to seek re-election. My sense is that the Democrats will find a candidate to run against her in the primary.
I mean, of course, everyone is innocent until proven guilty, but by the looks of things now, the rosy political future for Kathleen Kane no longer existing?
Yeah, I think even if she were to somehow beat the charges, I think the career is so damaged that it's not likely. Well, here's the point. If the Democrats run someone, there's no chance, in my humble judgment, that she's going to go on trial anytime soon. Trials now get postponed routinely, 2-3 years, with all these appeals, all the procedural questions. So what happens next year? If she gets an opponent in the primary, then she has to, first of all, she has to decide if she's going to run or not. Trust me, she will have an opponent in the Democratic primary, a strong opponent. And my sense from the polls that I've done is that her job performance ratings are not very strong. So given that situation, and the more the news comes out about various situations involving her, politically, I'm saying, not legally, politically, I think it's very damaging.
Terry Madonna is a professor of public affairs at Franklin and Marshall College in Lancaster. And he's on Twitter at Terry Madonna, M-A-D-O-N-N-A. Terry, it was great to have you on the program.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Before we go, the headlines were about Donald Trump and Megyn Kelly, but last week's Republican debate in Cleveland was much more. Here are just a few excerpts. There was Chris Christie and Rand Paul over the security versus privacy argument.
I want to collect more records from terrorists, but less records from innocent Americans. The Fourth Amendment was what we fought the revolution over. John Adams said it was the spark that led to our war for independence. And I'm proud of standing for the Bill of Rights, and I will continue to stand for the Bill of Rights.
And Megan, that's a completely ridiculous answer. I want to collect more records from terrorists, but less records from other people. How are you supposed to know, Megan?
Use the Fourth Amendment.
How are you supposed to?
Use the Fourth Amendment.
No, I'll tell you how you.
Get a warrant.
Let me tell you something.
Get a judge to sign a warrant.
Senator.
Go ahead, wait, Governor Christie, make your point.
Listen, Senator, you know, when you're sitting in a subcommittee just blowing hot air about this, you can say things like that. When you're responsible for protecting the lives of the American people, then what you need to do is to make sure that you use the system the way it's supposed to.
Here's the problem, Governor. You fundamentally misunderstand the Bill of Rights. Every time you did a case, you got a warrant from a judge. I'm talking about searches without warrants, indiscriminately of all Americans' records, and that's what I fought to end. I don't trust President Obama with our records. I know you gave him a big hug, and if you want to give him a big hug again, go right ahead.
Go ahead, Governor.
And you know, Senator Paul? Senator Paul, you know, the hugs that I remember are the hugs that I gave to the families who lost their people on September 11th. Those are the hugs I remember.
There was John Kasich talking about same-sex marriage.
I think the simple fact of the matter is, and this is where I would agree with Jeb, and I've been saying it all along, we need to give everybody a chance, treat everybody with respect, and let them share in this great American dream that we have, Megan. So, look, I'm going to love my daughters. I'm going to love them no matter what they do. Because you know what? God gives me unconditional love. I'm going to give it to my family and my friends and the people around me.
And, oh, did I mention jokes? My two favorites. The first from Scott Walker.
Well, first off, for the cyber attack with Russia the other day, it's sad to think right now, but probably the Russian and Chinese government know more about Hillary Clinton's email server than do the members of the United States Congress.
And second, part of Ben Carson's closing statement.
I'm the only one to separate Siamese twins.
The only one to operate on babies while they were still in the mother's womb. The only one to take out half of a brain, although you would think if you go to Washington that someone had beat me to it.
Although, think about it for a minute. How can Carson talk about separating conjoined twins when he plans to unite the country? And am I the only one who winced listening to Katie Couric talk about Ted Cruz's debating skills in this conversation on Yahoo News?
What about Ted Cruz? After all, he was, what, the debater of the year in 1992 when he was a senior at Princeton. He was named the national speaker of the year. Princeton was the team of the year. Not a good year for Harvard, Jake. Sorry about that. But will this serve Ted Cruz well? I mean, he is a master debater.
She really said that, didn't she? Okay, while that surprised me, nothing came close to what Mike Huckabee had to say in his closing statement. We were all convinced he was attacking Donald Trump.
It seems like this election has been a whole lot about a person who's very high in the polls, but doesn't have a clue about how to govern. A person who has been filled with scandals and who could not lead. And of course, I'm talking about Hillary Clinton.
Can the next debate be any better? We'll find out on September 16th.
Just can't get enough. I 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 just can't get enough.
That's it for this week's show. Political Junkie is made possible with support from WAMU here in Washington, and is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. For political columns, trivia questions, scuttlebutt puzzles, and bad jokes, and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter, check out our website at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or shoot us a message on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Our show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins. Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer. A.D. Quigg is our consultant. And Alex Drewinskis is our engineer. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. Thanks for listening. See you next week.